This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Melissa Idris, whose ears just got blasted out of space. Well out of, her head, actually.
That's
really.
Right. Well, it was always a pleasure to hear first syllables from Sharad Kutin.
I mean, you had volume up a little high.
It was a little bit high, yes.
Okay.
I forgot to adjust it.
Okay, it's the 26th of December. It's Boxing Day, a day that should be a national holiday. In fact, I think the whole week should be a national holiday. But I might be in the minority here when it comes to wanting Boxing Day. No, that's not possible.
A majority in the studio, at least.
Yeah, and I think, in fact, across
the
nation.
I'd vote for you.
Yeah, I mean, yesterday was Christmas. How can we be working today? I really don't get it. Okay. Anyway, it's the 26th of December. It's just slightly past 6 o'clock in the morning. We're taking you all the way to 10 o'clock this morning with an array of discussions and analysis that will curl your toes. Now, let me just begin with some Christmassy news that came over the weekend. Pope Francis has used his traditional Christmas Day message to call for peace for Jerusalem and a dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians.
Mm. So essentially the pontiff said, I think, not just for to ask the Lord for peace for Jerusalem and all the Holy Land. But he also said he touched on other pressing international issues, from the migration crisis to the conflicts in Syria and Iraq, from Venezuela to North Korea. So yeah. I guess, yeah, touching on all these global issues right now in his Christmas speech.
Right. And Pope Francis, of course, is the leader of the 1.2 billion strong Catholic community. Not the, that's a good part of the Christian, global Christian community. They, of course, Protestants and many different churches under that umbrella, and also the Orthodox churches. So, broadly speaking, there are three major strands in the Christian community globally.
He gives his speech in Latin, doesn't he? So is that right?
I'm not quite sure. That's very likely. But of course, he's from a Latin American.
Right.
So I don't know if he gave it in multiple languages.
Yeah. But the speech itself is called an Urbi et Orbi speech, which means in Latin, to the city and the world.
All right. Yeah. Okay, to Vatican City and the world, beyond it. He noted this... the question of immigrants, and he pointed to the Christmas story, of course, which has Mary and Joseph, the parents, as it were, of Jesus Christ, saying that they, in some ways, were akin to refugees and outcasts. In fact, if you watched Twitter over the weekend, there were many references that were political in an American sense. You know how Donald Trump came out to attack, because Donald Trump is not about love. Donald Trump's about hate and division. Right, so he's made nasty remarks about everybody, just
everyone.
About, but most recently I think about Nigerians and such, and so
Haitians as well,
right.
Yeah.
So somebody says, well, take the nativity scene now, remove the refugees, remove African people of African descent, remove, and then what are you left with? Basically, you're left with nothing. And so just to remembering the essence of Christmas is something I think that was in that tweet that went around. Also, just to note that the Council of Churches of Malaysia, General Secretary Herman Shastri, says that most churches here in Malaysia share the United Nations position on the question of Jerusalem with regard to the rights of Palestinians and Israelis to their homeland. So that is a conversation that I guess will be continuing. Mm-hmm. We'll be back with a look at online love. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the Christmas song by Hootie and the Blowfish. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris. And the morning run continues. It's coming up 8 minutes after six. It is Boxing Day, the 26th of December. And we're going to be talking Christmas a lot, I think, today.
It's Boxing Day.
It's still Christmas. Yeah, 12 days of Christmas. And I was told recently, because I put up a tree for the first time in my life, meaning kind of independently of parents and aunts and uncles. And I was told that you have to take it down by the 12th day or it's bad luck.
Oh, really?
I was thinking, I don't remember bad luck being part of the Christmas deal. But anyway, so I'm going to fulfill my, my duties and take my tree down. But until then, it's Christmas. Very interesting how Christmas has become a kind of trans-religious, trans-ethnic kind of celebration. Mm. And I was talking to a grab driver. She's a mother of two. And she told me, you know, kids really love Christmas. Of all the festivities, they love Christmas because it's about gifts.
I said, presents, yeah.
I said, well, but what about Chinese New Year? You get ang pao and, you know, and Hari Raya, so you get a kind of green packet ang pao. They said, no, it's not the same. It's about the presents. That's why the kids love it. And you can tell.
Yeah.
You know, even Malaysia, it really does blur the boundaries, apparently.
I have to agree with you. I think that almost every race has. I've seen many people, you know, even non-Christians, do the gift giving thing just to participate.
Especially the non-Christians,
because
I think.
Because it's, you know, year end, it's holiday season, you know, people want to have get-togethers and you don't want to be left out. So you just give, you know, you also participate.
And so you see,
gifts,
you know, in a lot of the reports coming out, there are, because angst in many different communities, religious communities who are not Christians, say, why are we doing Christmas, right? So if you read, you know, Jewish communities that celebrate Christmas, which is kind of like, kind of contradiction terms, and then of course, you know, Hindus in India and all that, and people making spirited defense of Christmas and gift giving, always every year.
Well,
the same,
you know,
story.
They could also argue for the commercialization of Christmas, so you know, it's not really it's gone kind of diverted away from the religious connotations to a more secular commercial.
Yeah, but you know,
element.
It's a fascinating history. I'm just reading something. You know, it was actually banned by the Puritans after one of the revolutions that Britain had. They banned Christmas along with all feast days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I learned something new yesterday as well about Christmas, that apparently in the Orthodox Christians celebrate Christmas in January. I think January 6th is the actual Christmas day.
Because
we were having Christmas with Serbian, I think, and then, you know, from the Eastern European bloc, and they said, well,
the
Orthodox Church celebrates it in January.
Yeah, they even have Easter on a separate day.
Yeah.
I mean, Christianity is a kind of complex tradition. Okay, coming back to more important things at hand, love online. Apparently, a young girl in China found out that the man she'd been dating online for 3 months, actually turned out to be a monk. Now, she was very unhappy.
It's a cautionary tale of dating online. So she found out that this man she was, you know, after 3 months of online dating, she asked to meet up with him. And it turns out that he turned up in a monk's robe in her hotel room in China.
So. Well, at least he's honest about it, right? He turned up in his robe, which he might have thought would be, you know, spicing up things. I mean, potentially. But, you know, I think the important thing is that she considered those 3 months online to be equivalent, perhaps, to a face-to-face dating situation.
Right.
And I think there is a generation who don't see the difference between the so-called real and the virtual. For them, it's all one seamless, flat plane, and everything is equivalent.
Which is why you made the distinction that she was dating online and not in real life. Apparently, she went online to rant about her frustrations after discovering that she was tricked by this man. And the backlash she got from netizens online seemed to blame her for being gullible and for, you know, to use their terms, for being desperate. So I guess that begs the question, should we expect a certain element of, you know, should we be suspicious or dubious over online dating profiles?
Well, I don't think...
Discount the truth a little bit.
Well, I think even in real life, you'd have to be a bit savvy. I mean, if, you know, in pre-internet, you know, people dated, and maybe in cities you just have to find specific places to meet people, because the city is full of people, it's dense, but your actual movements in the city and your connections are going to be limited, right? So if you want a larger pool, unless you want to be marrying the person who works at the desk next to you, you really want a larger pool.
Well, you know, now our parents and grandparents' time, it's not uncommon to hear that they were from, say, the same village or lived down the street from each other. So, you know, that's how people met and got married and had relationships and marriages at that point in time, because that catchment area, so to speak, was a lot smaller. But with the...
Well, families played a role in matchmaking.
Matchmaking, definitely, right. Yeah. But if you think about nowadays, I mean, how many people, you know, marry someone from the same apartment block because you've met at the lift lobby or while waiting.
That's kind of romantic, though.
It is. What do you call it? Cute, meet cute story?
Meet cute?
Yes.
That's cute as C-U-T-E?
Yeah,
cute?
Meet cute is what you call a lovely story you can tell your grandkids about how you met your spouse.
So we're coming back to this lovelorn lass from China who seems to think that she was done in. The question is, what kind of due diligence can you do online? You know,
stalking.
Well, yeah, you could. I mean, stalking is one thing, and the other thing is, I think my advice to any young person who finds themselves in situations next time, make sure you meet them at the start of the relationship,
okay.
And you know, don't take everything at face value, and you know, people can even Photoshop themselves. You know, they have terrible acne, scarred skin, and then they suddenly it's Photoshopped into this beautiful kind of smooth thing.
But precisely.
People
why,
change their complexion.
But precisely why I'm saying that if you have opted for the online dating, should you then discount the picture, the beautiful pictures that you see or the flattering angles of that selfie? Should you just assume that this is all superficial and perhaps, being glossed over?
Well, you know, there's another thing. I mean, we all cherry pick our experiences when we're sharing it with somebody for the first time. Mm-hmm. We're not going to give them the unvarnished truth, unless you're extremely honest. Most people just present the best of themselves.
Of
and I
course.
Think the online persona is just that, except, you know, like on speed or on steroids.
So do your due diligence is what you're saying.
Well, if you were listening to Uncle Sherrod early in the morning, yes, do. I take a risk or two. I mean, sometimes, I don't know what's wrong going out with a monk. It sounds like it could be exciting, especially if he was in robes.
Interesting.
Well, stay tuned. Next up, we talk about Indian teenagers in love. Oh my goodness, we continue the theme of love.
It is the season of love.
Love,
sure.
It is. Okay. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Cher with Gypsies, Tramps and Thieves. I'm Sherrod Kutin with me, Melissa Idris, and we've been talking about Christmas and some, well, not so cheery things, but things about love and affection,
love, yes.
You know. And I did tweet out earlier, as we do all our stories, the complex story of Christmas. So just there in the mix for you if you want to understand that history.
We also tweeted out the perils of online dating, that story we were talking about earlier about the young lass in China conned by the monk in robes.
Well, she's conned by her own desire, I think.
And we've asked you to tell us your best or worst online dating stories.
Yes, remember, you can always join this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or tweeting us at BFM Radio.
And your Twitter handle is?
At Sherrod Kutin, if you want to be involved in a heady conversation with me, Sherrod Kutin, at any time of night and day.
You can tweet me at Melissa_Idris.
Yeah. Okay, now we turn our attentions to India, where, you know, Christmas has been both a time of celebration, but also a pushback on larger forces, some of them quite intolerant in India. So some of the news flow over the weekend was quite painful to read because of, you know, Hindu fundamentalists were attacking churches and stuff. But beyond that, there is, in India, and we often think of India as a fairly conservative society, a story of how a hug between two teenagers at a school has turned into a story of note because those teenagers were expelled for doing just that, for hugging. Apparently, one of the teachers reported this complaint to the principal. They witnessed the boy hugging the girl. The boy was 16. The girl was 15.
Mm-hmm.
She just performed something, and he was congratulating her. And the very next day, both were suspended. 4 months later, the boy is expelled, apparently, because he and his parents refused to apologize.
Well, he said he apologized immediately after the hug. But apparently the school took issue with the fact that neither boy or his parents showed remorse. Now, the boy has said that it was a hug that only lasted... Sorry, the girl said that it was a hug that only lasted for a second or two. There were a lot of students and teachers around, and I didn't feel like I had done anything wrong, as she said. And, you know, both of them describe it as a congratulatory hug. So she had performed, he was proud of her, so he wanted to express how proud he was of her by giving her a quick hug. So it wasn't one that lingered, shall we say.
And even if it did linger, what would be the problem, right?
However, what the school has accused the students of is of engaging in an indecent, immoral, and undisciplined public display of affection.
So that's in quotes now?
That's in quotes, yes.
You know, what's fascinating about this is that it goes to the heart of the question of who gets to play moral arbiter in the lives of, you know, of you and me, right? In this case, it's the school that's mm-hmm. decided they're going to be the moral police. They're going to decide where the lines are. So perhaps we were talking to Tan Chung Han earlier. Who was also a teacher. Who was a teacher. And he said that he went to a conservative Christian school in the U.S. where girls and boys had different sidewalks, you know, and so you can take it to whatever level you want. But then the question is, does everybody buy into it?
Right.
And clearly these parents of the boys or the parents of the boys didn't buy into the norms that were being set by the school.
Well, the school has come out, the principal of the school has come out to say that schooling is also about the reformation of the child. So they see their role as teachers and as the school collective to shape the and punish and reform the child from wayward ways.
Baby, okay, so I think the thing is this, right? The belief by conservatives is that keeping boys and girls separate is good for them, and it's good for society. It keeps the social order. The conservatives believe that repression of the sort, is going to pay off dividends for society. Whereas I think, and I think many others who are on the more liberal side of the spectrum, think that this repression that we've seen throughout history actually produces just the opposite. Mm. It creates twisted, distorted people. How many religious figures do we know who've gotten themselves caught doing very naughty things, you know, because they actually essentially repressed individuals?
For me, specifically, I was thinking about how are we teaching our children to express affection? I don't think we are teaching our children. It's a skill, right? It's something that needs to be taught or learned because either you watch your parents or the people around you, but also you do need that outlet. And if you don't, you're not taught the right ways to express affection, then you have things like undisciplined public displays. I can't even imagine what is an undisciplined public display of affection.
Yeah, this is the other thing, Melissa.
Is that disciplined public displays?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, shaking hands or something. But, you know, Melissa, there's also very interesting development. I see it in Indian popular culture and films that where the theme of young men not knowing how to relate to young women has right. come up over and over again. The only models they have are their mothers, for mm-hmm. instance, in terms of relating to a woman. And this really makes it very difficult for them when they enter into married life to have equal relationships with women, especially women who have their own lives and, you know, want to be full. They're not there just to sacrifice things for their children, sons or husbands or whatever. And that is something that India is now grappling with, I believe, as it changes. Now, coming up to the first bulletin of the morning with Lindmark, we have you two bringing us there. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Such Great Heights by the Postal Service. Not our postal service, but the postal service. The postal service. It's a name of a band, apparently.
It's a band. It's a very popular band.
Is
it's
it
not,
really?
It's not Post Malaysia or the US Postal Service. But yes.
Okay, that was Melissa Idris. I'm sure it couldn't. It's coming up to 40 minutes past 6 on the 26th of December. It's a Boxing Day and time to talk Christmas, Christmas, Christmas. Now, over the Christmas weekend, because we had some tweets and some images go viral, and one of them was a slightly embarrassing one for the Malaysian airports. What is it called?
MAHB, Malaysian Airports Holdings.
Yeah, that's right. Malaysian Airports Holdings. And they had a bunting in Kota Bharu that read, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year's. Now, I said that very quickly, and you'd probably think, oh, that's reasonable. And they're very, you know, kind of part of the festive cheer. But actually, they spelled Mary as Mary. So it was M-A-R-Y
like
instead
the
of
name,
that's
yeah.
right, instead of M-E-R-R-Y. And of course, Happy New Year, became was sort of made plural. So it was like not just 2018, but for many more years to come. So this bunting presumably could be used once to cover, you know, now till eternity.
Well, you know, that photo went viral. I have to admit, when I first saw it, you know, on WhatsApp at a glance, I couldn't understand. Oh, I didn't see the spelling error. And then when, upon closer inspection, I went, oh no. So apparently the message on the bunting just below the logo of Malaysia Airports was only at this specific airport. It was only at the Kelantan, the Kota Baru, Sultan Ismail Petra Airport in Kota Baru. And the minute that the Malaysian airport company, that MHB, discovered it, they apparently removed
the... They were very apologetic.
They were very apologetic. But not after the image had gone viral. And a lot of people just started responding to my Christmas wishes with Merry Christmas and Happy New Year's. Yeah, it became a meme.
You know, the thing is, it is kind of funny on one hand. The other, because it signals what, you know, a lot of Malaysians, especially in the cities who are English users, lament about the falling, or the, you know, the disastrous standards that English has have come to after years.
So what did it trigger for you? Because immediately for me, I looked at it and it wasn't so much about the... you know, the lack of English, the levels of proficiency. But it was about someone was sleeping at the wheel here. Someone was incompetent, didn't proofread, didn't check. I mean, for every level, someone didn't do it. From the graphic designer to the comms, perhaps, the corporate communications to the, you know, someone must have proofread to the printers. Tell me the printers printed out and said, well, maybe I'll give the company a heads up that there's a spelling, something. There's a typo.
Well, people might not even recognize it. And so you have to say where this comes from, right? So, there are many English words, words in the English language that sound like each other, but spelled differently, you know, and so read, for instance, that we read a book, but you know the marshes are full of reeds. So then read, R-E-E-D and R-E-A-D sound alike. They're homonyms, right? So and I think Mary and Mary kind of sound alike, especially if you don't come from an English speaking background, you don't hear the distinction in the pronunciation. So I can see where this mistake might have originated. The person who wrote it thought, oh, this sounds like, you know, this is how you'd spell it, Mary.
And spell check wouldn't correct you either.
Yeah, because Mary is a legitimate, you know, proper noun. And so there's that. Melissa, I've seen at KL Central a sign, not bunting, but like a sign that said no swingum. And
what's swingum?
Chewing gum. So I was thinking, oh, this is a South Asian who wrote this, because, you know, I could just see how English words enter into the speech of people who, for whom it's not native, and who might turn chewing gum into swing gum, and, you know, and then right spell it.
How was that spelled?
Like sewing. Like swing gum.
Right. So, coming back
so
to this.
So I didn't, you know, I know the outrage that people felt. I personally thought, okay, like, this is the nature of how English is being used today, and this is the consequence. But you're absolutely right. Someone should have checked it.
I mean, I really was it not proofread, right? But this also brings us to the question of whether this online, you know, the backlash that we're seeing online was language shaming. So we, for me personally, my Twitter feed, I could see a lot of people just really, you know, going at this poor company who has apologized. But also, I mean, if someone were to hear the mockery of it, someone who, say, doesn't have the strongest grasp of the English language, would that deter the person from wanting to try to improve or to speak it? You know, practice makes perfect, right?
So yeah, but you know, this is a company that aspires to turn Malaysian airports into, you know, international hubs and stuff. So that's and it's different. So if it was like a 12-year-old boy or girl who made a mistake and everybody mocked them, and that would have been too much. And that's, I think, the kind of shaming that's unproductive and something we want to avoid. But when it comes to companies, nah, I don't think so. I don't think the same standards apply. Okay. I mean, the shaming thing really just applies to individuals. You know, this is a big corporation.
Apparently, it's not just a problem specific to Malaysia. Someone has just messaged us on WhatsApp to a photo of a banner from Singapore that reads, Merry Christmas. So M-A-R-R-A-R-R-Y, Christmas. So get married to Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Why
Merry
not?
Merry Christmas.
Well, Singapore produced some nice humdingers this weekend as well. Did you see the palm trees in fairy lights?
I did see
you
that.
You did see. But we can't talk about this on national radio because
it's a family-friendly show.
It is. Okay, we'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, stuck in the middle with you with by Steeler's Wheel. I'm sure I cut it. And with me, Melissa Idris. Kind of stumbled on that. Okay.
We just wanted to clarify very quickly that photo of the Christmas lights palm trees was not from Singapore. It was from a little town in Italy. Yeah.
I stand correct. Sorry to Singaporean brothers and sisters out there. they make other kinds of mistakes, but not this one in particular.
Never. They would fact check or proofread. I mean, someone would check that.
Okay. Last weekend, Apparat Mufti Tan Sri Hasrani Zakaria claimed that Muslims are forbidden from joining the candlelight vigil in memory of the Korean pop star Jong Yun, who died last week. He questioned the necessity for Muslims to pray for a deceased non-Muslim to go to heaven, especially when he allegedly committed suicide. In 2015, apparently, the National Fatwa Council declared the participation of Muslims in candlelight vigils as haram or forbidden for Muslims. The reason was given that such vigils are similar to other religious practices and may threaten the faith of a Muslim individual. Fascinating because, you know, when you looked at that story that young Malaysians were joining, what it was kind of a global outpouring of grief for the death of this Korean pop star. And I think we've taken this story in many ways, and we've looked at what the music industry does in South Korea in terms of these boy bands and girl bands and the very draconian contracts that they have and the pressure it puts on the individuals. The other side of the story, of course, is just the feelings of fans and why is it they empathize so immediately with the superstar idols?
Well, to be completely honest with you, I didn't realize there was a fatwa, forbidding Muslims participating in candlelight vigils or saying that it was haram. I assumed that a candlelight vigil was just to show respect or just to show empathy. And I thought it was a little ungenerous of the Mufti to say that, you know, you shouldn't pray for this, you know, someone you felt such a strong connection to. It also, I thought, raised a question for me. Then how do we teach our young people, teach youth who want to express empathy or who are feeling such immense grief over, you know, losing an idol or someone that they hold to such standards, then how do they express that? If it's not a candlelight vigil, then how do they express that?
Yeah, I think there are two ways in which the story goes. One is to the impulse of especially many religious leaders, whatever the tradition they come from, to assert difference. You know, I want to say this is our identity and it's always opposed to the identity of others, or it's distinct from the identity of others. So policing those boundaries of difference have become a very important part of the rhetoric of religious leaders or those who are leaders of identity groups, whether it's religious or ethnic or whatever. You know, so they're always kind of saying, well, we are different, so we don't want to do anything that makes us look like other people or, that expresses our common, common shared values or anything or practices. There's that impulse, I think. And sure. This is, I think, where it primarily coming from.
But that, I mean, I can understand that that's the fundamental issue, right? But we're so fixated on the no's and you can'ts and don'ts. What about teaching people how to deal with these feelings, how to express their emotions, right? So I find that language a lot more palatable and I respond better to that. So if you're telling me, no, you can't participate in a candlelight vigil, then tell me, how do I deal with these feelings of loss and
grief?
Well,
you know, some people might be say to you, Melissa, you shouldn't feel this way about this person. And just because he allegedly commits suicide or he's a pop star or that he doesn't share the same religious tradition as you do, and it goes back to that, you know, the initial impulse I said, but you're right. I mean, you know, it seems to me that just ordinary people have an intuitive sense of their common humanity than a lot of people who claim to have moral leadership. You know, it's a bizarre, somewhat paradoxical kind of situation. Those leaders are actually creating more division and distinctions, whereas normal people just react from feelings and, and you know,
as,
and
a fellow human being, someone that you've listened to. And I guess I was thinking about, why is it that we feel so strongly with celebrities? You know, perhaps we've listened to his songs or his music constantly. It becomes a part of our lives. It's how we mark, you know, occasions or milestones in our lives. And to lose that person can be, you know, can leave quite a void.
Yeah, and I think of a lot of young people who are under similar pressures themselves. Maybe not, they're not superstars, but they understand the pressures that society puts on them, expectations, right? So maybe they empathize on that level. I know what you're going through. I know what it is to feel pressure as a young person. Very, very sad situation. And hopefully, like you say, we'll be taught how to empathize rather than what not to do. Well, taking us to the second bulletin of the morning, The Counting Crows with Colorblind, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris. It's coming up to 7 minutes past seven. It is the 26th of December, Boxing Day. Merry Christmas to all of you who celebrate it. Time to look at the other season. It's the season to be jolly, but we're also moving to another season, aren't we, Melissa?
Yes.
The season we call the elections.
Yeah. I think, can I stay in the holiday season? Because I think it's much more festive.
Yeah, it is generally much more festive. In fact, there are signs that we entered the election season, because the next general election is the 14th general election, is that the tone of public debate and discourse and rivalries and, you know, or differences have taken on a much more a sharper, perhaps nastier turn. And I think that's something that perhaps upset some Malaysians. Some Malaysians maybe respond to that. And that's a question that is still open. But somebody who's just weighed in on this is celebrity cook Chef One. He recently revealed that both sides of the political divide have been courting him to join their respective campaigns ahead of G14.
That's right.
Citing a Malay proverb, Chef One said he didn't want to be trapped, or as a deer, as it were, trapped between two sparring elephants.
That's a lovely proverb. So he's saying that he has been approached by both UMNO and the opposition to go on various campaigns, because supposedly that the villagers will come out and see Chef One. So he's, I guess, perhaps used as a draw, or like a marketing draw, right? Okay, Chef One is coming, so everyone will come out and perhaps attend a ceramah or two.
And maybe he'll cook for everybody.
Right, perhaps, yes. So what really struck me, Sharad, was his quote to say that politics can be such a filthy game. Today, people adore you. Tomorrow, well, look at Tun M. What have they not done? What have they not done to him? He was, of course, referring to Tun Dr. Mahathir facing a barrage of attacks after joining the opposition. But what do you think about, what do you make about that comment, you know, that politics can be such a filthy game? He takes this tone that perhaps he doesn't want to wade into the political arena.
Yeah, I think there are two sides to this story. One, people who say that, in fact, the country is at a crisis point, that we're poised between a much more authoritarian, kleptocratic future, and others who say, well, you know, this is like any other election, and we have to, you know, go in there and weigh our options, and we don't have to push, you know, necessarily to one side or the other. And so you can hold back a little bit, and you can be perhaps stand above the fray, or, you know, you can even be a fence sitter and not be vilified for being on the fence and wanting to weigh your options. Mm-hmm. I think those are two images that we have before us. And so for those who believe that the country's at a crisis point, you know, it's kind of a take no prisoner kind of situation, right? You need to stake your claim. You put your flag down and say, on which side are you on?
Mm. I do think that I kind of agree with him that the tone, I mean, you know, that it's gotten a little bit, the political arena has gotten so, I think, too much bickering, that there's a real feeling of fatigue, and not just among kind of urban voters, but I think it's, you know, throughout the country, that heading into this general election, so I get the sense that people are feeling a lot more fatigued about the political imbickering, the you know, that there's been no sort of solution to big economical and financial issues. So I'm just wondering whether he's just expressing that, and perhaps that might resonate with a lot of people who say, well, you know what, I too want to perhaps sit on the fence this time and not wade in.
Yeah, in fact, we have this problem, people not registering as voters, right? Mm. And in the millions. So especially with the younger demographic, who are often associated with voting behavior that that emphasizes change. And so young people are more likely to vote, not just for the federal opposition, but for a different kind of politics. And the fact that they're now opting not to participate is worrying. Of course, it's worrying for the political parties who see themselves as natural recipients of this, but it should be actually worrying for everybody. In fact, I believe the Prime Minister came out and mentioned this number. It was over 3 million people who are not registered. And so the question is, and it always comes back to this, you know, is the system designed to encourage people? Do they put barriers towards voter registration and such? You know,
I'm just wondering what the difference is between, say, Malaysia and the U.S. Because from what I'm reading, and this could be an echo chamber or a filter bubble, but from what I'm reading, I remember this quote from an op-ed piece in the New York Times. This young person had written in to say that, in 2016, I was complacent, but now I'm furious. And in 2016, I was a voter, but now I'm an activist. So there's a real feeling of wanting to participate in the political landscape as a voter, as an activist.
And in response to Donald Trump and his very divisive politics.
And he wrote that, in the 2018 midterms, GOP, we're coming for you. So it really was, I think, a sense of, well, I've seen the Donald Trump in office in 1 year and now I want to do something about
it. So people are radicalized by the experience.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, what's the difference between the two, our two countries side by side, whereas people feel a lot more fatigue here in Malaysia and perhaps not as fired up as in the US.
If you look at the last two general elections, you had 2008, which the result of which kind of snuck up on us and took everybody by surprise. I know people now say, well, I knew it was coming, but because nobody then, I don't believe, actually knew it was coming. And then in 2013, extraordinary exuberance going into it. But especially for those who supported the federal opposition, the payoff wasn't as great as they thought. So maybe it's about a kind of disappointment, that so much more could have changed but didn't change. And now, and you could accuse people like that of impatience, that, in fact, political change takes time and you don't want to rush it because it could actually be disastrous if you do. But, or they actually seen the record of the federal opposition, not particularly inspired by them. There could be multiple reasons. Or they feel that, they buy the argument, buy the Barisan Nasional, that stability trumps change, and therefore, they want to go for stability in a time of increasing insecurity over jobs and such.
If we could come back to Chef Wan and some of the comments he made about being courted by both sides. Now, he says that, of course, everyone has their political differences, but why is everyone so vicious with hatred and vengeance? And I think that, for me, resonated. Perhaps, I'm seeing this kind of so much hostility on both sides, and I'm thinking, well, that is exhausting. I'm already dealing with a lot having to in my daily life.
There is a question of a vacuum in moral leadership, and some royal houses are trying to fill that space with the kind of gestures they've made. I think in particular of the royal house of Johor, and so people are warming up to royals as a political voice because they see a kind of moral leadership there that they see is absent in the much more pragmatic Machiavellian politics of normal politicians on both sides of the divide. And so, you know, they're not warmed up to that. And so they see these other voices. And then there are others. I mean, just this weekend, we had young people celebrating an event from 70 years ago, the API, you know, the Angkatan Pemuda Insaf, you know, and decking themselves out in 50s gear and marching in the streets of KL, remembering this. And, you know, you think it could be a kind of performance, but it's also about saying, let's reclaim politics for young people, remembering, you know, two generations ago what young people were inspired by. And so a lot is happening in the mix, I believe, because Chef Juan will tell us exactly what proportions that mix ought to be.
Campur je semua, as he would say.
Does he say that?
Sometimes.
He's a little more sophisticated. That. Isn't he Cordon Bleu?
He is.
Chef. Okay. We'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.